President Cyril Ramaphosa has acknowledged that the government is 30 years behind in creating a plan for early childhood development.
Sectors of society await the tabling of the budget tomorrow. The early childhood development sector sits concerned over the possible reduction of a 10 billion rand allocation contained in the leaked budget speech that was meant to be presented in February. Educators say the funding is crucial to overcoming challenges in township and rural communities. They hope government recognizes the essential nature of ECD education and show commitment to its success.
It starts long before a child pulls on a uniform or hears the scrape of chalk against the chalkboard. Before a story is read aloud in their mother tongue, before a balanced meal is ladled onto a plate for school lunch, a choice is made on a spreadsheet, in a vote, in a line item of the national budget. That single stroke of a pen can swing a door wide open or bolt it shut. For millions of children across South Africa, that door never even cracks. Consider this: in 2023, barely 27% of 3 to 5-year-olds had access to any form of early learning program. 1 in 4 children under 5 was stunted by chronic malnutrition. And despite education taking one of the biggest bites of the budget, more than 70% of grade 4 learners still can't read for meaning in any language.
These aren't statistics. Their future being shaped or stalled by the quiet, invisible hands of fiscal policy. So when we hear phrases like economic recovery, sustainability, or investment priorities, the question we must ask is, for whom and at what cost? Welcome to Our Voice, Our Future, powered by Breadland Africa. We're your hosts, Eirik
and Solvay.
And today we are tuning a spotlight on the cost of the future, how government budgets and economic choices shape the lives of the youngest citizens, and how we can make children visible in the boardrooms, budget speeches, and balance sheets that will define the next generation.
We're joined by Kelly Morkel, an impact strategist, change catalyst, social entrepreneur, and self-published author with a passion for unlocking people and organizations' heart impact to drive meaningful, lasting change. With experience across the private sector, government, nonprofits, and social enterprises, they bring a rich, interdisciplinary perspective to every project. Today, we'll unpack why children remain invisible in economic modeling and how that must change.
All right. I'm just going to... Should I just kick it off right away? So I just wondered, why do you think that children are often left out of the national economic conversation and budget model?
That's a loaded question. But I honestly think that they don't think necessarily that they are left out, simply because they cater to education, they speak about things. I think the biggest thing for that is I would rather ask, are we actually targeting the needs of the children? So if you look at, the budget speech, or we know what has been said, they're contributing to the schools, they're contributing to ECDs, which is a big thing. And even in the donor space, I'm not too sure, like 2 years ago, it was very about matriculants and all of those things, and now donors has moved towards ECDs in that sense. So similarly, there's a more focus on foundational in that sense. So with regards to navigating in terms of funding or even like allocating funds for and then being part of the conversation, I think it's really, are we looking at the basic needs and are we aware of what the basic needs is with regards to children and the education space? I don't know if you want to unpack that some more.
Yeah. Could you maybe give us like more exact example of this, or like?
Yeah.
I realize.
So for me, if I look at the budget speech, they say they're contributing X amount. Okay, I don't know it offhand, so I'm not good with the numbers, but they're contributing. But when we look at, I'm not too sure, you guys. Do you know of Maslow's theory of law? Maslow's theory. Mm-hmm. No, No. Okay, cool. No. I'll break it down. So Maslow's theory, it's like really this pyramid.
Pyramid, of course.
Like the basic. So you have your basic needs, your safety, your, you know, all of those things, place of belonging, and so your needs.
We just, yeah.
Caught us off guard, I guess.
You guys passed, so don't worry. So in terms of Maslow's need, if we think about the first one in terms of food, you know, I need food, I need nutrition in order for me to obviously learn and develop and grow. And within the South African context, we focus on first 1,000 days, where it looks at the first 2 years of a child. And so one, in the budget, are we focusing on that basic needs? Are we focusing on the safety aspect? And so we're looking at the environment itself. So when we're speaking about the environment, it's the infrastructure. So do I have water and sanitation? Do I have like proper windows? You know, do I have gates around? And then also the safety within the environment. So we look at these basic necessities before I can even learn something in that sense. And then additional variable is the teachers. And so are we actually, you know, looking at the teachers and their needs itself? And so we have this money, this quantity, but what does that actually mean in instance of practicality and implementation of that? I don't know if that does that answer your question just in terms of an
yes,
example.
But I wonder, like you say that they're not, they are focusing on the children, but they are not prioritizing the needs of them. But what are the money and funding going to otherwise?
But that's exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying. So we breaking it, but are they breaking it down? Is government breaking it down? And this really comes into collaboration, you know, and co-laboring together. So part of my experience is I've been in government, both national, provincial, and local. And so I've been in the health industry where we have to work with education, or, you know, we have to work with the nurses or all of that. And so you see there's different crossovers where there should be, but there isn't. And so I am not speaking to education from health, and health is not speaking to infrastructure. And so when I say about the basic needs, are we actually collaboratively targeting the needs of the children in that sense? So that's where my, you know, because I've been in government, are we really working together? And is the budget actually talking towards, are we working together, or are we duplicating money? And maybe that's how money is going missing. I don't know what's happening. South Africa's, it's all over the media. They always speak about it. But that is just, is it aligned? You know, because we have education, we have health, we have transport, we have all of these infrastructure. But where is the crossover taking place? Mm-hmm. And so I look at the budget speech and me for is like, great, you're allocating funds. But how is that funds actually being utilized? Just think about systematically in terms of South Africa. And if you look at apartheid, how certain money was allocated for this and that in terms of color. So there is already a stigma of silo approaches that we innately have because of our past history. So you bring it into a government or even in a corporate, doesn't matter, you have to change the culture within it. So now we're not speaking about money anymore. We're speaking about people. We're speaking about culture. We're speaking about systems. And for me, South Africa has beautiful policies. They really have great policies, but it's not been implemented.
What would you say is the link between earlier childhood development and long-term economic and societal outcomes?
I was like, it's such a big...
It's a big question.
No, it is a big... Because, I mean, ECD is linked to social. ECD is linked to economic. For me, the first thing that comes to mind are teachers, are the caregivers. And so when we look at them, are they actually capacitated to the right level in order to bridge that gap? And so I think I'm just speaking in a South Africa context, in a Cape Town, Western Cape, because that's where I'm from. And I've also worked a bit in Bloom. So just in terms of dynamics, is that are we capacitating the ECD educators, if I can say it like that, or managers or owners, first of all, that they are running a business? So a friend and I, we often speak and we say that in South Africa, we need to make money. Obviously, the economy is not that great. A lot of people are struggling. And so everything is hand to mouth. When we speak about hand to mouth, it's literally what I'm earning right now in my business. It's literally going, I need to eat. And so when I start, and because of my experience within the community, ECDs pop up like babies. I'm sorry for the pun, but I mean, it pops up like babies, simply because there is a gap. So an ECD generally starts from a day mother. So day mother is like, I can have 5 to 6 kids, and then they charge a fee and they're like, hey, wait, I can make money, you know, there's more. So now I increase it, and all of a sudden I become an ECD and I'm charging money and it's great. But if I can work with a 10 rand or 100 rand, how am I going to work with 1,000 rand? How am I going to navigate? I know I'm going to go back to the kids now, but we're talking about the link in this regard economically. And so I almost want to say, are we the ECD institutions, like, first of all, stewarding their money correctly and bringing that over within not only the children, but the communities? Because if I say, for instance, I'm paying, say, 3,000 rand for my child to go to a creche, he would have a meal. He would have outside, you know, play area, inside play area, extra murals, because that's a lot of money every month, you know. It's like it's almost like varsity fees in that instance. So there's that, the institution itself, and then linked to the community. But then are we actually bringing that over to the kids? And I have 2 nephews. And they have market days. And so market days, the parents, they have to make something literally out of like recyclable materials they can't buy, but they have to make it. Not necessarily recyclable, but make it themselves. Bring it to school. They have a table set up. And I'm telling you, some of the parents go all out to make a stall and everything very fancy. Mm-hmm. And then each class gets to come and buy, but they give them these cards and they bring card machines and they tap. The parents is already, you know, pre-hand bought everything for them. But the concept of, I can look what I want, it costs something, I'm going to buy it. And in that sense, so that exchange of, and so if I as an ECD owner understands the importance of that exchange, you would want to teach that lesson to the child, but also to the parent in itself. So I'm really, and I'm speaking from a context of middle class to lower class ECDs in that sense, because that the concept of hand to mouth is literally there. But that's also where most of the ECDs are popping up, and where the need is in that regard. Similarly to socially, and we can say something as simple as kindness and even sharing, a social aspect of it, is that, again, teachers, we often, and in the East, we learn by what we see. Mm. So if I see what or how the behavior is of the teachers, and I spend most of the day in that way, and obviously with your parents, then that's also a form of, but we are still living in very broken societies where, I mean, there's so many social ills, and we can list them, you know, and I think it's in every country, to be honest. And so the question is that link, are we actually dealing with that link? Because everybody always says the kids are our future, the kids are our future. But if the present is broken and not being capacitated, how are we supposed to invest into our children, which are the future? Yeah.
I guess just to follow up, it's, of course, just gathering from what you explained there, of course, a simple investment in one ECD can open a lot of doors, it seems like. So, of course, how does this relationship justify greater public investment?
Oh, wow. I think I'm just going to use Braden Africa as an example, because I think it's amazing that that's already, even though they're an NPO, but it's also private in that sense, and outside of an ECD. So similarly, that it's infrastructure. The biggest thing that ECDs is infrastructure. Compliance-wise, it is infrastructure. Most of the ECDs cannot get the social development certificate because of compliance. So just in terms of just a little bit of background so that you can understand, there's a health clearance certificate that ECDs are required to obtain. And then there's also the nutrition, the planning, the lesson plans, the safety, all of those things. And it's those two packs that goes to social development. And the reason why I'm saying this, because I was an environmental health practitioner for the city, and we were the custodians of the health certificate. So we had to run that whole process with the different departments. And so what we saw is that the infrastructure was either dilapidated or it wasn't sound. And so in that instance, coming along, giving an ECD the proper infrastructure, which is safe for both the teachers and the children, already puts them, you know, in a better step and in a better. And sometimes that infrastructure might be a safe haven for a child. We don't understand. We don't know where they come from. We don't know, you know, the homes and the environments. And so if they come every day to a sound, good, wholesome structure, that's already contributing to create a safe space for the children. And again, to the previous question about the social, that link, infrastructure can also be a link in that regard.
And also just to follow up, like, I really agree with this because of what the last part you said about like the teachers also being kind and like the children's observing what they are doing, and also the teachers being able to be in a good environment will also affect how they appear. So it's like a vice versus
observant. And we,
observant.
And we forget that in terms of EQ, we think everybody has it. We learn, we go to school, we learn from whether it is the church, our parents, organizations, sports, we learn from. But our emotional intelligence is not necessarily, it's through experience, it's through exposure. So if teachers are only exposed to gender-based violence or alcoholism, those things, and they come in and they have an opportunity, and they have this opportunity, and I'm like, I'm going to work at an ECD, this is great. I might have gone for the course, but I don't have the emotional intelligence for it.
And this is something maybe many people take for granted.
100%.
Like, yes, people think, like, okay, working with kids, automatically everyone understands how you should behave around them. But it's not like that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. So regarding the next questions, with the South African economy under pressure, where should the government prioritize funding to safeguard children's futures?
Woo, everywhere. I think I'm just gonna backtrack to the previous question.
Yes, it's quite
there's quite a few things. I think the biggest thing is first in terms of the capacity building. And I think it's capacity building for the ECD teachers itself. Mm. I think that is where we can start with in terms of investing and really investing what the need is. So if we know, and I'm also, because I'm a semi-researcher, I'm also very much, let's do the research. And I think the biggest thing is we don't have a lot of stakeholder engagements where we can sit with a group of ECDs and a group of politicians and then also bring them together. I mean, in an ideal world, oh my word, that would be great, you know, bring everybody into the room and be like, or say, hey, this is the problem. How can we address it in that sense? So for me, it's really starting with that capacity building. And I'll just share a bit about, you know, when I was working in government is that we hosted these workshops because we went in and we said, what is your need? What do you need to know to make your ECD better? To understand what is it? And so we hosted workshops, and it was compliance in terms of what they needed to comply from a safety aspect. So the fire requirements and understanding what they need and why they need is so important. You can tell someone that they need to do something, but if they don't understand why they need to do it, they won't do it. They won't make that change. And so the same thing with the kitchens. Something as simple as understanding that they actually need to have a door or a gate that the kids can't come into the kitchen area because it's dangerous. And again, that's what they do at home, but it's not their kids. They need to understand that. So we did workshops and we obviously educated, and then they're like, we need nutritional planning. And the biggest thing is, how do we give our kids good nutrition on a budget? That's a good nutrition on a budget. And so we brought the dietitian in. She put some meal plans together, explained, you know, the different types of food and what they can substitute protein with in that regard. And it was great. At the same time, part of our responsibility was to prevent the spread of diseases. And so hand washing, something as simple as hand washing, but also to know that there isn't always running water. From UNICEF, I think a lot of countries has actually implemented it in that sense. It's a tippy tap, or you call it the squeezy tap, or the tippy tap and the squeeze bottle. I mean, we've called it the squeeze bottle. So it's literally, you make a running tap out of a 2-liter bottle that they can put in their classrooms in that sense. So there's a lot of capacity building that I personally think that should go into the teachers and across board. So if you look at obviously knowledge-based, how do I teach a lesson, all of those things, but also intellectually, how do you resolve conflict? How do you identify if a child's been abused at home? Small things. We take it for granted that, you should know because you're in that industry. But with that budget, we say it's towards children. But if part of that budget is capacitating the teachers, the ECD teachers, that would be, well, that's my answer.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you. And then what are the trade-offs policymakers face, and what principles should guide those choices?
Basically, what is the policymakers getting in return for investing into the teachers?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Okay. A better society. Like, let's just be, that's actually what we want.
Yeah.
I think it's always about, and I say this, what is your hidden agenda, policymakers? I mean, there shouldn't be a hidden agenda. But, and also in terms of finances, if you're going to invest in this, or is there a hidden agenda? Or is it the actual fact that you want to target one of the SDG, the Sustainable Development Goals? That's the hidden agenda. Or actually, that's the agenda.
Yeah.
But is there a hidden agenda? So for me, I think that the trade-off in that regard is actually creating better societies, better quality societies in that sense. And when you say quality, we're looking at a person holistically. I'm a physical being, I'm a spiritual being, I'm an emotional being. And so how am I contributing to that? However, policymakers and finances goes hand in hand, and the social aspect is lacking. And so again, I think it's really about policymakers should actually, the trade-off should be, I'm seeing a sustainable person, you know, a sustainable community. And I say that because, and I'm going to draw it quickly. This is going to be very funny. Mm-hmm. But when we talk about sustainability, we talk about people. We talk about planet.
The three Ps.
Yeah. And we talk about profit. And so if anything is that, I mean, you want those three, right?
Mm.
So, I mean, in essence, we want that sweet spot, I would like to call it, in terms of the policymakers, they want to create sweet spot communities. Yeah. In that sense, because I'm writing a policy so that people can advance, so that the planet can advance, and so that profit in terms of finances can, you know, advance in that sense. And so any sort of even compliance, if you think about it, I'm literally, I'll use a kitchen, for example, because I know the food industry very well. If I'm going to, I have a legislation policy that says your kitchen needs to look like this, and I go and enforce it. This is where the why becomes important. The compliance is there for the people so they don't get sick. In that environment, so now the planet, which is the environment of the kitchen, it's clean, it's healthy, And so now they're compliant, which means that they can operate legally, which means you won't get a fine if you open and you don't have. And then that means if I'm compliant, that automatically means I can do business, which equates to profit. It's a silly example. But I always say that compliance equals opportunity in that sense. And so if our policy is in that sense that it's creating opportunity when we implement our policies, that should be the trade-off.
I guess you kind of like touched up on this question, but how would you say that an ESG framework help us think differently about children in the context of national budgets and business strategy?
So I love this concept, this framework. Absolutely love it. And so much so, even circular economy, which I also love, the concept. And I think the biggest thing is that we need to stop understanding that it's just a framework, but actually implement it. And I think that's the biggest part. And that's what we need to answer is, are we implementing it? And how can we implement it within our organizations, in our businesses, so that when it comes to the point of, listen, it's here, the legislation is here, this is how we need to do it. So I'm just going to give a few examples. So when I heard about circular economy, we're going to start with the E. The circular economy, that's part of the E in ESGs. So I'm a self-published author as well, and I run workshops and everything. And one of the workshops is very much vision boarding. And so obviously it's magazines, you're cutting and you're pasting, and there's a lot of paper that is being wasted. And I'm like, I don't want to throw this paper away. Like, I don't want to just, you know, I have to recycle. What can I do with it? And so because I have merchandise, I have my books, my bookmarks and earrings that I sell, I'm like, can I make packaging? Like, can I, you know, make packaging in that sense? And so I, with my dad, I trialed to pulp paper. So I don't know if you've ever like seen pulp, literally paper, you shred it, small pieces in water, literally. And then we created a frame out of wood and then like this, like a chicken mesh, but the very fine ones, you kind of just shake it off and then it's paper, you pulp paper. And so we trialed in terms of making packaging for. So now I'm like, I'm making packaging, which means that I'm going to reduce my inputs for my business because I'm not buying packaging, but I'm also taking waste from a service that I offer and I'm putting it back into the product in that sense. So now I'm taking circular economy and I'm making it practical for me.
Yeah.
So back to the ECDs, if you have a workshop with regards to that, and a lot of people, since South Africa, there's dumping sites, we all have dumping sites, but there's also dumping spots where our communities are just throwing their waste away, you know, and it's polluting our environment. And so as an ECD practitioner or owner, what am I doing with that? Can I take it back into my lesson? Can I take it back into my veg garden? You know, then can I have a campaign where I'm in middle to low class communities and say, hey, everybody needs to bring 5 bottles every week or every day. Because, I mean, that 2-liter plastic bottle is going to be in that house, you know, because there's going to be a barber shop around the corner. And, you know, same thing with something as simple as your egg cartons, the board trays that you have. There are so many activities, fine motor skills activities, you know, color activities that they can use. And now we're saying we can't say that we don't have resources, because now we're utilizing what's coming from the community. We're using it and going back into the ECD that we can use to educate our kids. And so now waste becomes a commodity.
Yeah.
And so now we're literally just changing the concept of that for a child, because adults has waste is waste. I'm going to throw this bottle away. I'm going to throw this plastic away. But now by an ECD changing its model of bringing waste in and asking for waste, and showing the kids what they can do with it and them learning, you are now changing. Again, to the policy, that's the trade-off.
Yeah.
Because I decided to capacitate my ECDs. And that's only the E.
Yeah.
That's only the E in that regard. Yeah. So that is, and automatically now you're creating a business-minded, a slight shift in terms of the owner and the teachers. Mm-hmm. And like I said, again, creating that model in that sense.
I was just wondering, you're speaking like, okay, we have to implement the ESG, but, and you were mentioning like, okay, in Europe, in the US, they're already like, on their way, they're good at implementing it and or in the process of it. How long do you think it would take for South Africa to get there, or like their state in implementing it right now?
Yeah, I think they won't implement anything until it's registered. Once the document is there, it's signed off by the president and great, and now you must do it.
Yeah.
But for me, I say take a step back. We see what's happening. We can see the advantages that it actually has. And so why can't we start, and this is again in terms of government and the public-private, our NPOs, is to assist businesses, so SMMEs, your NPOs, your ECDs, in terms of understanding what it is and how can I implement it. So ultimately part of ESGs in big corporates, they are going to want the suppliers to have ESG in the company, some sort of ESG principles and frameworks. The same thing, it's probably going to be linked down to the corporate social responsibility. So now I'm a donor and I'm like, what are you doing? Do you have some sort of ESG practices? So why are we waiting until then? Why can't we start now? And this comes back to the public-private partnerships, is that government is not going to do that now because nobody signed off on it. Why are we investing in time that we don't have because there's so many things that we're not getting to because we're under-resourced with people and everything? So they're not going to focus on it. So this is where the public-private can come in and start capacitating. And it's something as simple as having a couple of years ago, I was involved with an ECD conference. So I helped organize it, put it together. Over 120 ladies came. Well, not I say ladies because majority of ECD owners are females. Sorry, guys, if you are out there, I'm sorry. in that regard, over 120 showed up. We had breakaway sessions with regards to HR, compliance, nutrition, all of the things that we knew because we did that basic needs assessment of what is required. Why can't we host in that gaps? So we're looking at ESG and like, what are the basics that is required that will elevate, you know, the education, that will elevate the education, the experience, the social aspect of it in that regard. So really making it in that sense, like again, so back to your question is literally we can start now. And this is where we say public-private comes in with the various organizations, both business and education and even health to a certain extent. No, to a whole extent actually, because if you have a sick child, you know, and nurses, you need your vitamin A, you need your polio, you need all of these things in order, that's linked to the first 1,000 days. And then when it comes to that, we need to implement it. We're already on our way. That means me as a supplier that wants to tender for a corporate, then I'm already on my way. I'm like, not, oh my word, what do I need to do? And there's 10,000 things that I need to do. And all of a sudden I'm at the back, you know, I'm at like 2, 3, 4, 5 steps back. Because now I have to do all of these things that's going to cost me money. So if I'm starting out as a business or starting out as an NPO in that regard, and they say, hey, listen, here's this framework, even with regards to the theory of change. I mean, we spoke earlier on, sorry guys, you missed out on that conversation, but we'll just jump back into theory of change and we say, my theory of change, my outputs, and my outcomes linked to my impact. How is that contributing to the ESG in that sense? And so that's why I said in the beginning of the question is, are we educated? Do we actually understand it for what it is? And so it's understanding it in its silos, but actually how does it come together? Because if you look at it, our people, profit, and planet, isn't it the same thing? Our environment, social, and governance. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing.
Pretty much, yeah.
Pretty much.
I was just wondering, do you see that kind of, of course, if there's more of a, some business owners maybe having like a more conservative view and focus mainly on like profit, and they regard, they don't take account of the other two and how they may be running away with some of the profits, and how that, because it's a part of like the a mental shift as you went through earlier, and how can you navigate this?
Yes, I love this question. Simply because
basically like shareholder stakeholder perspective, I guess, is the
definitely
change. Yeah,
so definitely mind shift, perspective shift. So I'm gonna say, and this is probably easy to explain, you get an entrepreneur that is profit driven and they're all about the business, so it doesn't matter what happens, they're always going to focus on how much money can I make. And listen, there's nothing wrong with it. And then you get a business owner is like, and some people might say this is an NPO, but you get business owners, entrepreneurs that are, I want to make an impact. My product needs to make an impact. My service needs to make an impact. You have these two. Entrepreneur, social entrepreneur. Entrepreneur, yeah. Social entrepreneur. Yeah. And so it was so funny. I was chatting to one of my friends and we were having this conversation. And it's like, you are definitely an entrepreneur. I'm like, I'm a social entrepreneur because I think about the money lost and he thinks about the money first.
Yeah.
And I think it's about getting to that sweet spot of being a social entrepreneur, because entrepreneurs that are profit driven, they are bound to have to give in terms of corporate social responsibility again. And how do they do that? So understanding that. My friend politely said, well, if you want to make an impact, you need to make money first. And I'm like, ugh, darn, yeah. You're right, yeah. You know, in terms of it. So that mindset, I think it's more of, we have a lot of incubator programs. I think it's all over the world. It's not just here in South Africa, but very much third world. They have these business incubators where they teach you all about business and finances and things. And so that mind shift comes into incorporating it. I don't think we are in times now where everything is separate. Like 5 years ago, they were like, oh, these are sustainability. Oh, these are engineers. This is health. This is, we can't be. When it comes to, if we think about ESG, everybody needs to work together. And how do you integrate that? And so it's incorporating that. And so, again, back to the compliance aspect I spoke about, is that will ESGs or the framework, the principle of it, afford you opportunity? If you position it in that way, then the business owners would be like, whoa, whoa, whoa. So you're telling me, if I do X, Y, and Z, that means I'm going to have more opportunity in the next 2-3 years if I start now. It makes sense money-wise. So the pitch of ESG, I think, is very important, yeah. You know, because someone in a social entrepreneur will jump on it quick. Like for me, instance, I can see the impact because I look at the environment, I look at the people, and I look at the impact that I want to make. Someone that's profit-driven, you need to speak money. So it's how you pitch it. And again, the principle is amazing, but are we actually pitching it to on the level of a business owner? And now we're talking about small, medium, and obviously huge enterprises, and similarly for organizations and NPOs, so that they can understand the magnitude of the slight shift, but the opportunities that it will have long term. Yeah. Yeah.
This is really important because it's often there the big money lies, right? Or in the private sector, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking of, I had one question just to kind of play like the devil's advocate.
Go! Oh, yeah. I love it. Go for it.
I was thinking in terms of like, if you want to go like switch from, you want to work with social entrepreneurship. You said earlier that you're a research-based person as well. And a big topic there is conflict of interest, of course. So if you mainly work on social impact and you then start to make money and you become profitable,
yeah,
do you see that as a challenge in becoming, because people maybe start questioning the conflict of interest, are you in it for the money or are you in it for the impact. Mm. So it's kind of like balancing profit and impact.
I think it's not necessarily about the conflict of interest, but rather is like, what is your primary function?
Yeah.
You know, and from your primary function, what is the secondary? Is your primary function the profit and your secondary the impact, or is your primary focus the impact and your secondary your profit in that sense? So my secondary, in terms of making the books in that sense, it stayed there. Actually, it was my primary for my business, but it became my secondary because I started consulting. So in that sense, I hope that makes sense, just in terms of full circle.
Yeah.
And I think that's what businesses should be open, transparent about. I think that's the biggest thing. If you have two legs in your business, and I would always say, think logically about it, long term about it. And I would say, again, to answer your question, if it is that there is a big impact part, then the question is, should you not then register an NPO? Because now you have these two functions. Or I have an NPO and I provided a product that's booming. You know, it's making loads of money. And now you're like, but this is amazing. This is a whole business because I need to sustain it. So now you can say, and it's like a deal. Now I have an organization that's both a PTY and an NPO. And it can run and function like that. And the one can feed to the other.
Yeah.
A simple example is when you register your business, they say, who has the shares in it? Your NPO can have the shares.
Yeah.
It's legal, from that point. But we also don't know about it. If we don't speak to people, if we don't engage, if we don't go to conferences or workshops, we don't know. So something as simple as the ECD, compliance affords opportunity.
I guess just to follow up, how can investor and private sector actors be a part of the solution in making these frameworks truly accountable?
There's so much, but I think boils down to that basic needs analysis, like I spoke to about earlier on. First of all, I know that all private sectors, they have their own principles, you know, their values. And so normally when they do sponsor or fund, it's in line with those principles. And so I think it's more of what that linked to what area, what community do you want to do? And then actually finding out private should do their research in terms of what the community needs rather than what they think the community needs. It's a big difference. And because, again, and this is the dangerous thing about research, is that we can do the research and be on the outside, but you have not lived in that community. And so you might think that the what they need is more shops, for instance. But actually, they're like, no, what we need is you to show us how to catch fish.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give us it. We want to learn.
Yeah.
And so I think it's so important that there should always be that stakeholder engagement approach before they invest. And this is, again, where the civil societies and the NPOs comes in that are on the ground, that are working and saying like, okay, this is, what is it? And that's, again, linked to the impact. And so I would say that is the link that needs to come in place in that regard, is really truly like, what is the need of the community? Because if we invest in something that we think the community needs, a year down the line, it's going to mean absolutely nothing.
Yeah, thank you. And then for the last question, if you had 60 seconds with the Minister of Finance before the next budget speech, what would you say about investing in children?
I think I'm more asking questions rather. I'm like, that's 66. I'm like, you know, I'm going to sound very controversial. I'm going to use that 60 seconds and I'm like, a minister, who are we investing in? Are you investing into your future or the children's future? I would actually just ask him that. And let him ponder. Because we say we invest into the children's future. You know, we want to build legacies. But actually, if you think about the decision making, are they making decisions for their own legacy or for the children's legacy?
Yeah.
And the children's are the future. So.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
As we have heard today, children may not sit in budget meetings, but they live with the consequences.
Investing in early childhood development isn't just good social policy. It sounds economics, smart governance, and a moral imperative. Thank you, Kellen Morkel, for helping us understand the cost and opportunity of shaping a future where no child is left behind.
To learn more about the work Breadline Africa is doing to support early childhood infrastructure and advocacy, visit breadlineafrica.org. If you want to take action, share this episode, tag your local representatives, and ask them how children are represented in your country's budget. Use the hashtag OurVoiceOurFuture to join the conversation. Until next time, thank you for listening.